What can the music industry learn from traditional journalism? By traditional, I mean the actual news, people who go to war zones and report back, people who chase down massive stories because they know that they matter. And as you might have gathered with this series, as much as I'm interested in the music press and where it's headed and TikTok and all sorts of other things, I'm really curious about what the music industry can learn from outside of its walls. I've spent the last two decades really being inside the music world. When I went to work for the BBC, I got a little taste of how the BBC news team do things. So when I started thinking about this series, I started thinking about who the people I really wanted to talk to were. And I really wanted to speak to like an international correspondent, a reporter, and someone that's been there and done it. And I was really thrilled when Julia McFarlane agreed to do this conversation because I've followed her online for years. I've listened to her One Decision podcast with Sir Richard Dearlove, who was the former chief of MI5, where she's interviewed ambassadors and political leaders. It's a really interesting, in-depth listen, which we touch upon at the end of this conversation. But she's the kind of person, when you Google her, you find that she's got both a Forbes 30 under 30 and a picture of her in Gaza reporting. And she's a self-shooting TV journalist. She talks a bit about how she goes out on her own with camera into reporting on things like the Syrian refugee crisis. She's also spent time for ABC on the lawn outside of Westminster reporting on Brexit and stories like that, making sense of them to American audiences. This is a proper conversation about journalism. I am thrilled that we managed to cover so much ground in such a short space of time. And I really hope that if you hadn't really considered how the news reaches you and why truth is important, then this is the conversation for you. So I'm asking everybody to start each of these interviews with, what's your definition of journalism?
I think my definition of journalism is the practice of recording events as they happen. And, you know, that sort of, that quote that we are all told in journalism school, and I sort of hate repeating now because it's such a cliche, but that's sort of about journalism being the first rough draft of history. I think that's probably, I think maybe the reason why it's so repeated is because it's pretty simply, it is just record taking. It's the practice of recording things that have happened because it informs us in the years to come. And I think it's important that you have professionals who are trained and very used to the practice of trying to record things as accurately and as impartially as we can, taking our own tints out of things. It's very interesting when you do any kind of historical research and you look into what records and what documents are around deep in the annals of history. A lot of it's very subjective. One of the things that I found most interesting when I was learning all these different subjects at school was I did theology at school. And there's a really interesting aspect of like reading and trying to analyze bits of the Bible and trying to work out what was true and, you know, stuff that's written thousands of years ago, like the Gospels. We don't know who wrote these things. We don't even know if Matthew, Mark, Luke and John are actual people. We don't know if they're the same people. It's all sort of, everything's quite subjective. And although with the Gospels, they all describe the same, a lot of similar events, they're all described in different ways. And of course, Chinese whispers and the fact that there were oral traditions back then accounts for it. But I think there's something really nice about, particularly living in such a fast changing world as we are at the moment, trying to find a way of noting down into the written record what happens so that it's there and it's recorded as impartially, as accurately as we can. And I think that's important.
I think one of the words that jumped out there, and I don't think it was meant to, was the word training. So it'd be good to get a sense of your background. I liked that one of the first things I read about you is that you grew up listening to World Service, which having had a granddad that worked in shipping was something that I grew up with quite young. And I'm always surprised when I meet people that haven't really listened to World Service because it's such a unique and wonderful thing. Did you want to give people a quick introduction to you and your career?
Yeah, so I mean, I lived overseas. I was born in Asia, and for I think a lot of English speaking families, the BBC is a very important part of keeping in touch and having access to not just your background and events happening at home, but you know, it was a way of keeping connected to our home, to, you know, our family who were still living in the UK, in a place like Indonesia, where it's very dominated by American culture. I think English culture doesn't have much of a reach there, at least in terms of, you know, what's accessible in the English language. It is mostly like American TV shows, American children's shows. But listening to the BBC World Service was a way of not just getting reliable news out there in Asia, but also it was just so interesting. And something that is very, I think, quite unique to the BBC World Service was that it's so clearly made by people who just have an insatiable curiosity about the world. And it doesn't matter where a country is from, if there's an interesting story to be told, you'll find an editor on the World Service who will commission it. And so my father, this drives me mad, but my father, who is a long-time insomniac, he listens to the World Service, and he's done this for about 40 years. He listens to it in the middle of the night for an hour or so, and he'll so often tell me about a very interesting story or an issue or a person or an interview or something that he heard on the World Service when, oh, it was around 3 or 4 o'clock, and I get so stressed out, and I say, Dad, you should be sleeping instead of listening to the radio. It's really heartbreaking how it's just been ravaged by cuts recently, and it's a real shame that the British government don't seem to recognise how precious it is as an institution and how it really is the envy of the world. It seems to be something that is totally apparent to everybody apart from our own government, which is a real shame.
You think in the world that we've got right now, having a broadcaster that's available all around the world that's about truth and accuracy would be a national asset? And I think there was like 2 minutes in Parliament where I think the Tories said how great the reporting was on Ukraine before going back to months of getting rid of the TV licence fee. But I don't want to get too deep into that, because I think we probably both talk about that for a while, because I know that you also did a stint. I did 4 years at the BBC, and I think you were there for similarly kind of length of time. Is that about right?
I was there for about 6 years. I had a sort of a year freelancing with them in the Middle East before I then joined the newsroom in London. I started maybe a year after I graduated, and I left in 2018 to work for ABC.
And
which was quite a culture change going from BBC to a US network.
That was exactly going to be my question. How was the contrast of working at such a big institution? And then, because you're primarily a broadcaster on TV and radio and also in words. I think that's correct. Correct definition. Was that the correct pyramid order?
Yeah. I was mostly a TV journalist at the BBC. I mean, I started in the World Service. I was very lucky to have a couple of years working on one of their flagship current affairs programmes. And I sort of went around the place at the BBC. I did some work at Milbank. I did BBC London reporting. I was on the World TV channel as a producer for a few years, worked on the website. Most of my time at the BBC, I was a producer, and I very occasionally got a chance to do my own stories. But then I got this incredible opportunity to go be a foreign correspondent at ABC. And that was in 2018. And Trump was the US president. There was the coronavirus pandemic. There was the withdrawal of Western troops from Afghanistan. There was a lot of news going on, Brexit as well. It was a really busy period.
How did you find explaining Brexit to Americans? to American audience.
Oh, God. Do you know, I had to do lives about the backstop. Do you remember the Northern Ireland backstop? I didn't even really understand it. And I remember I was on College Green and I had a few lives that afternoon lined up, and I was trying to work out how to explain it to an American audience. But I was also repeatedly told by the desk, don't bother trying to explain it. Don't bother trying to understand it. Like, we just have to, you know, basically call it a fudge because that's what it was. And I was like, well, yeah, I feel a bit like I'm cheating by sort of glossing over the details because it is quite important. And I was just on College Green, and I ran into Chris Mason, who is the wonderful political editor at the BBC. And I was like, Chris, can you please explain to me what this bloody backstop is? I'm supposed to explain it to the Americans and I don't understand the clue. And he was generous enough to try and explain it to me in sort of 10 minutes he had in between his own words. No, he didn't. And I can't even remember exactly what he said. Bless him, he tried. And I was still like, I really don't understand. He was like, oh, he gave it his best effort. But it was interesting because basically ABC is very, like a lot of US networks, they're very domestic heavy. The foreign international coverage is very much secondary. And, you know, with the exception of CNN, a lot of the American news outlets are like that. And so foreign news had to reach a certain sort of fever pitch before they would let us get on air and do anything. So whenever I did turn up on College Green, and I'm sure it was the same for my colleagues, the other correspondents, Ian and James, when we were on College Green to do a UK political story, everyone else was saying things like, oh God, it's definitely bad news if even you guys are being pulled in to explain this in front of the Americans, because we weren't always there for every Brexit twist and turn, but for a lot of the things we were. But it was tricky. I think Americans were sort of generally interested in Brexit, not the more bureaucratic elements of getting the deal, renegotiating the deal, all that kind of stuff. But I think they were interested in the story in that it was such a rebellion by the UK. It was such a rebellious thing for the British electorate to do the thing that we were all told not to do, and for us to then do it. And I know a lot of people disagree with me, but I honestly think it contributed to Trump winning. I think the way the British electorate broke the rules and sort of gave their sort of fingers up to the establishment with the Brexit vote was something that the Americans paid attention to, and they sat up and they thought, oh, we can actually, you know, do the crazy thing and elect the reality TV star to be our president because the Brits have done this crazy thing by saying that they want to leave Europe, which everyone said was impossible.
And at that point, no one could see the damage it was causing and the fact that we weren't benefiting very much from it. But maybe there are some benefits. I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg's got a TV career out of it. That must be one benefit for someone.
You couldn't possibly glean me on to talk. I think it's interesting because, you know, there's a lot to say about Brexit. Yeah. But one thing I think that is a recurring theme is I think a lot of people don't engage with other people who are different from them. Yeah. And I think there are a lot of people who are frustrated. And I think there's a lot of people who feel left behind. And the trouble with social media, and in many ways, parts of, you know, the press, particularly the tabloid press, is it kind of farms those emotions and it kind of feeds off that those kinds of divisions. And I think it's the kind of thing that results in Brexit and results in Trump. And social media, unfortunately, particularly Twitter under Elon Musk, only seems to be encouraging a lot of those divides and those divisions instead of helping to bring people together.
Which goes back to why the truth and accuracy is so important. So when you're not on air, and to what extent is the holding pattern of news gathering and kind of understanding stories, trying to get yourself up to speed on something which you might be on TV about tomorrow, or how does that work?
I think it depends on what job you're doing. I mean, ABC, it was very feast or famine. We weren't in the central newsroom. We were in a foreign desk. So it was a quieter bureau. You know, when I was at the BBC, I was in the central newsroom. And so everything was busy. And it was, you were on your shift work and you were doing your daily news. And it was nice because there was daily gratification of putting the program together and looking at what was on the news that day. And always easy to do your own projects and do some more in-depth reporting, whether that's a documentary film or an online explain or anything like that. But that was always stuff you had to fit in your own spare time. ABC, I think there was a lot of, there was, it depended on what breaking news was around. And the trouble with ABC was trying to get a story that had a compelling reason why it was of interest to an American audience. And that was something I did find that I missed a lot about the BBC, was it did, it all, a good story only had to qualify by being interesting, not, you know, oh, Americans won't be interested in that, or, you know, oh, there's no relations with that country, or, you know, there aren't many American expats in that place, and so it's a bit too random. That was a nice thing about the BBC, and it still is. It's one of the few media organizations where you don't have to qualify your stories. If there's an interesting story to be told, there's always someone who will be willing to commission it. At an organisation with the scope that the BBC has.
So one of the other things that I think people might find quite interesting is a lot of your reporting has been kind of self-shot, like you've gone to different places and filmed things. How, like, to begin with, that's what the training required for that is obviously something where you need to learn how to use everything and make sure you capture it and you've not been sent halfway around the world and it doesn't sound or look good. What does it involve when you arrive somewhere? Like, I don't know if you want to talk through maybe one of your reports that you've done and like the prep, the landing, the story, the things that you're looking out for when you arrive. Like, how do you piece together a story like that?
When I was shooting my own things, it was a lot of work, I'm not going to lie. I always shot with an SLR. Which is they're basically stills cameras, and they've come on a whole lot since I was using them in news gathering. I mean, my partner and I went to see The Creator in a cinema the other day, and that apparently is shot with one of these tiny little handheld cameras, which is just amazing that to have a big splashy sort of blockbuster shot in one of these things. But when you're going to do this sort of the video journalism thing, it is really difficult because you have to have a part of your brain engaged with different aspects of the reporting. You have to be listening. When you're doing interview, when you're shooting an interview, you've got to be thinking like the reporter and actually listening to what they're saying. But you've also got to be looking to see if the light is changing or if they're moving out of focus. And then you've also got to be thinking of the edit. So, you know, are they talking way too rambly? Is it going to be difficult to cut? Do you need to ask them to say to say the answer again in a slightly more succinct way? And so those trips were always really full on and really difficult, not having anyone else in my team. And that was the nice thing about being a foreign correspondent in the more traditional way, is you're very much part of a unit. The correspondent has her own job, the cameraman his, the producer his, the sound man his. And so it was very nice working in a team, having more sort of symbiosis, because it means that you can be fully immersed in your own job and trusting your colleagues will do all of their own jobs. But, you know, that's limiting. It's more expensive to send four or five people instead of one person. There are some stories that I wouldn't have been able to do if I was in a team of mostly men. And so, you know, there are different reasons for doing those kinds of deployments, and certainly there are different times where being a one man band or being a video journalist definitely has its positives.
Because that's something which even a generation ago probably wouldn't have been as possible, to have sent just one person with gear out to do things. To what extent, in some of that reporting, have there been sort of bigger challenges of trying to, like for instance, as a music writer, I've turned up at festivals or turned up in cities doing coverage, and I kind of know a few contacts I'm going to speak to. I get a sense of the person that works in this record shop knows everything about what's going on in the music scene, so I chat to them, and I end up being introduced to someone who's a radio journalist who then drags me to a gig, and I kind of get to know the city a bit more quite quickly through the eyes of other people. Which I imagine is not the same as turning up in a war zone or somewhere where there's civil unrest and things are quite dramatic. How, or is it similar?
I think you're right. It, a lot of the elements of filmmaking are the same. If you're doing everything yourself, you're always looking for you know, what will make nice B-roll, what illustrates the story that you're trying to tell, who are good voices, what's the best way to get them to tell their story, and thinking about, you know, locations and where you want to film stuff. I think there is a huge like democratization in the tech that allows you to do this. Now you can just go with your iPhone and very, very basic kit, and it allows people to do essentially the same thing that news gathering crews have been doing for years. And it's a nice way to tell a story that feels a bit more filmic, that's a bit more crafted. And I think it's important that people know when, you know, when you're watching a news report or you're watching a documentary, people are trying to tell you something interesting, but they're also trying to entertain you in a way. They're trying to keep you interested and keep you, and show you why this thing matters. And so making something a compelling watch, that's the same whether you're, you know, you're watching a feature film or a documentary. There is a lot of thought behind how a lot of these things are crafted, and a lot of editing that is basically people trying to produce something that tells the story that they're trying to share in a compelling way.
And is some of that trying to find the shared humanity? Is it trying to the familiar brands or the familiar toys and things, like something that I think is quite, even though we live in a global country, like some things are quite consistent. Are those some of the things you're looking for when you're trying to report a story?
Yeah, I think, and this is true of a lot of the different organizations I've worked with, that they're having a sort of a personal angle is always centered in stories. Whenever you're, you know, and that's whether you're doing a film about the cost of living crisis, or you're doing a film about a tragic sort of, you know, social issue, or you're doing a news story overseas, you always try to find good voices. And what that means is someone who has a story to tell that people back home can identify with, or will resonate with, or will feel empathy for. And I think that's always one of the most effective ways that journalism can do good, that it teaches people in one country what life is like in another country. And because I think a lot of the issues with society these days is sort of fear of the unknown. You know, if you look at the migrant crisis, a lot of people feel threatened. Oh, there are lots of people who I don't know, who have a different culture to me. I don't like it. You know, oh, it makes me feel uncomfortable. But actually, if people were sort of given the chance to learn a bit about people in other countries and see that there are some differences, but a lot of differences are superficial. At the end of the day, people have families and people want to provide for their children. They want to pay the bills. They want to get on with life. I mean, we're all pretty much the same. You know, society works in a way that it has worked for thousands of years. And only things like, you know, how we divide our days and the tools we have, very superficial things have changed, and the important stuff has always stayed the same. And I think journalism and travel writing, or even films, even, you know, feature films that tell fictional stories that have important truths in them, these are all ways in which humans can learn about each other and interact with each other and understand each other. And I think it's an important part of life, really.
Because at the moment, it feels like Manchester United football shirts and Taylor Swift are two of the things where people can naturally understand the people. I think it was a Nick Robinson report. You were talking about one of the football shirts one of the refugees was wearing coming across from Morocco or somewhere, that just felt quite a small detail. But I imagine for some people, quite quickly humanized a story of something with people that have been quite demonized by society. One of the things that I found interesting about working at the BBC, and I think as an outsider, it's quite hard to make sense of, is the concept of neutrality, but the ways in which that's important. Like, I would be hard pressed to go through your feeds even now to figure out whereabouts your alliances and allegiances are beyond being interested in the news and how it impacts people. And like, some of the things that I found was, well, we can't make a statement on this, but if you want to speak to someone that's got something interesting to say about this topic, or if there's a statistic that jumps out from reporting around this topic, then you can make some editorial decisions over what to highlight. Like, for instance, there was quite a big campaign in the music industry to bring gender kind of equality into festivals. And by pulling out a statistic that just showed that it was something like 12% of the lineups were women, it really drove home the reason why we needed to move towards equality. It wasn't Six Music's accounts, which I was running, saying, this is a problem, we need to fix it. It was, this is the problem. I don't know how you, like, I imagine in the news team, you would have been talking about a lot of these things differently, but I suspect you probably understood it quite naturally from growing up listening to it.
I mean, statistics are so tricky because you can find statistics to back up any narrative. Mm. You know, you can find some data that will reinforce your own beliefs, and you get that a lot on the internet, people chucking out, you know, stats here and stats there to back their own side. And so certainly at the BBC, it was, you know, they treat polls very carefully because there's a poll that shows your team is winning no matter what team you're batting for. I, you know, having worked in the center of the news pit on the 6 and 10 o'clock news, on the news channels, I mean, there is no sort of conspiracy by people trying to suppress things, trying to, you know, slip things in with that. That's really not how the BBC works. And in fact, you know, it is part of the culture that everyone does try to do. It's something that's so normal when you work at the BBC. You know, you leave your opinions at the door when you come in. It's, you know, I think people who have never worked for the organization say, oh, it's so biased, it's this, it's that. They don't really understand, actually, it is just embarrassing to be seen to be biased or to be subjective in that organization. And everyone is at pains to not seem so. And I think, you know, when there are errors, when there are issues, it's usually stuff that's accidental. It's stuff that, you know, people are understaffed or they've missed something or something's been dragged in the wrong pay or whatever. Yeah. Cock up, not conspiracy, as they say. But I think with things like statistics, that's why context, I think, is very important. That's why it's important educating yourselves as journalists about issues, and that involves going places, speaking to people, you know, reading a lot of information, trying to learn about what it is that you're reporting on, because I think there is a space for analysis, and I don't think that sort of clashes with the need to be objective, because I think analysis can be objective. You can bring your own experience and what you've observed and your own sort of interpretation of it. And that, I don't think that necessarily clashes with your own opinions. But I think it is useful when news organizations, they mark out their analysis and they, you know, they put it in a separate section. And so you can read Chris Mason's interpretation of a budget or a, you know, a Queen speech or whatever. And, you know, maybe Peston's will be slightly different. And I think all that feeds our sort of reading of news events, experience and analysis by people who've been covering these patches for many years,
which dovetails into talking about the podcast that you host, which lots of experts talking in a lot of depth about. So do you want to explain a little bit about the podcast, because I've listened to it and I understand, I reckon, about 80% of some of the very complex topics, but some of the topics which I probably would have only known 10% about before listening, so it's been, some of the episodes are really
that's
eye-opening.
Great. That's great to hear. Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what I was missing at ABC, which was very, like, brevity was the key thing at ABC. We had very sort of short opportunities to tell stories. And the podcast I'm doing at the moment, One Decision, is totally the opposite. We interview politicians or former politicians, people who are academics in their field or experts or people who campaign on issues. And we usually record an interview with them for an hour, and then we usually record a little bit of analysis or a bit of a debrief with Sir Richard Dearlove, who used to run MI6, and he's my co-host on this. We present the program every week, and some of the topics I choose, some of the topics are determined by some of the guests who we bid for, are able to come on and schedule a time to talk to us. And I've certainly learned so much. I have to do a huge amount of research before I do these interviews. And it's wonderful having access to the people that we do and having the amount of time to talk to them that we do. And it's something that I have missed, because broadcast, particularly television broadcast, is so time demanding, in the sense that you only ever get a minute or so to do a story, or maybe a few minutes, 5 minutes max to do an interview. But the opportunity to sit down and have an hour long conversation with key decision makers has been really, really great. And I've certainly learned a lot of it. And I approach it from a place of hoping that other people learn things that they didn't beforehand.
So just one kind of final thought on all of this. So to be on TV for like a minute and sum up a story, from my experience of what I like to call bonsai pruning sentences to make them work on social media, do you feel like the research required to do an hour-long interview and the prep required to do like a minute segment might actually not be that much difference in terms of time taken? Or I'd just be really curious, because the message might reach people differently and the medium is very different, but I wonder whether there's a lot of a similar crossover of the skills.
Well, certainly if you're doing news, if you're doing like your standard sort of 1 or 2 minute lives in a news sense, generally something has happened and you're just explaining what has happened. Particularly if you're a correspondent, as I am, the analysis is more left to senior correspondents or editors. And so it was always my job just to explain what happened, how people have reacted a lot of the time, and anything that might be coming up soon that's related. And so there maybe is not a huge amount of information at all. I mean, certainly if there was a breaking news story and we didn't know that much, I would so often be in the kind of situation where I would say what had happened. Let's say there's some kind of like explosion or something in Stockholm, which is what was actually a story I had to do once. And of course, everyone wonders if it's a terror attack. But so far, all you know is that there's a bus, there's loads of smoke, the driver's gone to hospital, police have closed the roads. They're investigating, and then the anchor will say, well, we'll ask you a question, and you actually can't answer because you've already said everything you know. And so you have to sort of, you know, find a way of saying, you know, whether the chief prosecutor is going to make a statement or if the police are going to have an update later in the evening or things like that. But often you actually don't have a lot of information, but you still have to say what you know and what sort of fact checked and true, and what you can go on air with. I mean, the amount of reading in that I do for my podcast interviews on One Decision is way, way more information at my fingertips than doing a sort of a live sort of reactionary stand up on a street where something has happened.
So this series is all about the future of music journalism, but I'm also a media nerd, and I'm curious about where media might be headed. And one of the things that struck me, having started a website back in the year 2000 and seen the internet erupt and explode and seen how that's changed things like news, there's been quite a few stories, especially around like deaths of very famous musicians, where like a TMZ or someone will report it before any of the facts have been checked. And there's been quite a lot of places that have posted things for clicks and it's turned out they're not true. And I'd just be curious, firstly, whether some of the kind of things that you've talked about accuracy and truth and like making sure that something's factually, like, I think some of the fact checkers at the moment, like some of the best accounts on reporting the news are people taking us something that's had 3 million retweets and going, this is actually not true. It's from 5 years ago. I'm just curious where you think news is headed and what you think is going to be important to it going forwards. Sorry, I realize that sounds like a leading question, but it wasn't meant to be.
Well, I think people will have no choice than to see a difference between, you know, channels on Twitter who just spread false information and media outlets and journalists who actually have editorial checklists and standards. And they are accountable to the practices and the regulations of their industry. And so there is a lot of work that goes towards standing up everything that is broken on air. And I think actually, you know, Elon Musk has done a really good job in showing people how important it is to have journalists and how important it is to have people who understand how to cover breaking news developments rather than, you know, some guy in New York who, you know, is putting out stuff that he's seen on the internet that's happening in Gaza, even though he's never been there and doesn't know any people there. And, you know, I think the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a classic example of how information is weaponized, and journalists are trained to how to handle that and how to deal with it and how to use it responsibly. You know, people randomly on the internet who may be very influential because they've got lots of followers and these newsfluencers, you know, they won't have the contacts, they won't have the resources, the agencies, the resources that media have. And mainstream media has had a bad rap the last few years, I think unfairly. But I think the sort of the maelstrom of disinformation that is the alternative, I do think that people are going to have a newfound respect for journalists, or at least that's my hope.
Yeah. A newfound respect for journalists, imagine.
I hope so.
Well, thank you for your time. We managed not to talk about your interview with Boris Johnson. But was there anything else that we've touched upon that you just wanted to, that you didn't get across? I'm giving you the chance to redo something.
No, I thought that was a really interesting conversation. And I think, you know, all journalism, whether it's music journalism, news journalism, you know, cultural journalism or entertainment journalism, I think, you know, you mentioned that you felt there was a bit more subjectivity in journalism that is more focused on the arts. I think, you know, if you're a theatre critic or you're a reviewer, obviously that's a space to have your own opinions and things. But I do think what journalists do, no matter what your beat is more or less exactly the same, explaining what has happened. And I think if your subject matter is something that's a bit more ineffable, like music, like, you know, like art, like movies, there is a bit more space to be a bit more interpretive. But not in terms of putting your own opinions out there. Because essentially what we're all trying to do is we're all trying to give people information. And, you know, if there's an arts journalist who's writing about, you know, why Martin Scorsese should stop making 4-hour movies, you know, and maybe Flowers of the Killer Moon should have been a limited series or something. You know, they won't be, unless it's an op-ed, they won't be reeling off their own personal opinions about it. They will have talked to other people. They would have talked to, you know, people involved in the business, and they would have crafted an article that has lots of people's thoughts and ideas. And that's very similar to news journalism, you know, getting sources, getting people to contribute to an article, getting quotes from people. The practice is very similar. And there's, I think it's, journalism is quite, it is a practice that is, that there are some old fashioned rules that we all abide to and that we all know. And I think that is what sort of differentiates working journalists from bloggers and writers who have their own place, who have an important place, but it is something that I think should be celebrated, and hopefully the mainstream media won't be quite as bashed around in the future as it is these days.
So I think it's that difference of what you're going to value. I think it was Helen Lewis who I heard use the term nut picking, where people pick one tweet and then put a whole click-worthy news story around it, and like that doesn't feel nourishing or valuable as a piece of media. So I think people are adjusting their media diet to the things that they know have got value and substance to them. But then obviously if something can inflame people, that's going to give them a whole different set of things. But thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening to the Drowned in Sound podcast. This episode was hosted, produced, researched, and edited together by Sean Adams. See the show description for more information about Julia's work and check out the One Decision podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider sending a link to a friend or leaving us a review on Apple or Spotify. Bye for now.